This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Okay, parents. Yep, I'm looking at you. How old was your child when you first started adding solid food to the little bundle's diet? According to a new survey, if you're like a lot of parents, you did it too soon.
The infant doesn't need the solid foods at that age. They're getting all the nourishment from breast milk, or if they're not breastfeeding, from formula.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to a researcher from the CDC about their new findings.
We'll also hear from the NIH about another problem that seems to be coming from our diet. A lot of us are becoming frail. And we'll hear about age-related macular degeneration and how you can take some steps that might help save your sight. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Think back to that day when you first introduced your child to solid food. Okay, maybe that day is just a wistful dream right now. But the point is, the CDC says a lot of parents, a little over 4 in 10, are doing it too early, and that could be causing problems. Here to talk about this new research is Dr. Kelly Scanlon, lead epidemiologist with the nutrition branch of the CDC. We spoke about this study, which was called Infant Feeding Practices Study 2. So I asked, when was number one?
So the number one actually was in the 90s. This was an FDA study, but this study was done from infants were followed from 2005 to 2007. They were followed for the first year of life. We've just completed a follow-up of those infants now 6 years of age.
All right. And what was this study looking for?
Yeah, this study was looking at a variety of issues around early infant feeding, breastfeeding, food consumption, reasons for not breastfeeding, reasons for discontinuing breastfeeding. So that was the entire study. This particular study that we were looking at, we were interested in the age at the first introduction to solid or semi-solid foods. This includes all the baby cereals and purees, et cetera. We were interested in whether that age of introduction varied by whether the infant was breastfeeding or formula feeding. And then we were interested among those who introduced early, which would be earlier than 4 months before any health authorities at that time would have recommended introduction, what were their reasons for introducing solid foods? Mothers chose from a variety of reasons when they answered these questions. And we followed these infants over the first year, so we have nearly monthly reports of their food intake.
Now, you say 4 months. The American Academy of Pediatrics has been warning against introducing solid foods. Was it 6 months?
Now, the preferred age of introduction is about 6 months. But at the time we did this study, The guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics was to transition to solid foods between 4 and 6 months. So we specifically looked at before 4 months because for the last 20 years at least, the recommendation has been not to introduce before 4 months.
And with some pretty interesting findings is that about 40% of parents were doing it.
About 40% of parents were feeding their babies solid foods before 4 months of age, which is earlier than recommended by health authorities, as I mentioned. We saw some differences by type of milk feeding. So infants who were formula fed were about twice as likely to introduce solids early compared to those who were solely breastfed.
And what were the reasons given for this?
Right. So then we looked at a variety of reasons. And the top reasons there were about 5 or 6 reasons that more than 50% of parents or mothers responded to. So the top reason was that nearly 90% of the mothers who introduced solids before 4 months reported that the infant was old enough for solids. So for us, that indicates the need for better communication of the recommendations on solid food introduction and the potential health impacts of early introduction. We also saw about 50% of mothers who introduced earlier than recommended, meaning before 4 months, reported that their healthcare provider said the baby should begin solids. Now, we were not interviewing the healthcare provider, so we don't know what the healthcare provider actually did recommend, but we know at least it was the mother's perception that it was okay now to introduce. So that kind of, for us, indicates that healthcare providers need to provide parents with very clear, accurate guidance, but also then support parents and help parents in carrying out those recommended feeding practices.
Does it make you think that perhaps the providers might need a little education too?
Well, again, we don't know that that was the information that the provider actually gave, but you know, there's a variety of healthcare providers that a parent may see. Parents receive information from a lot of sources, but it's best that they use those evidence-based information, those recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Some of the other things I read were that there's this myth of it helps the baby sleep through the night if they're given solid food.
So about 46% of mothers did say that 46% who introduced early said that they introduced because it would help their baby sleep longer at night. That is not a reason to be giving babies additional food. Sometimes babies will wake because they do require more milk feeding. There is no need to be adding solids before recommended.
And there was an economic quotient to it, too.
We did find, such as other studies in the past have, that we had a higher prevalence of early introduction of solids among women of lower income. Also higher income among younger women, women with less formal education. Also higher prevalence of early introduction among infants who are participants of the special supplemental program for women, infants, and children. That has been shown in other studies as well, and really was not the focus of our study. We really were focusing on the reasons because other studies have reported some of those same characteristics.
What are the reasons for introducing at 4 months? Are there problems if you introduce it any sooner than that?
That's a good question. So first, younger infants are just not developmentally ready for solid foods. So there are signs of readiness that parents, clinicians look for. Infants should be able to sit up, be able to open their mouth when presented with a spoon, take the food off the spoon, not spit the food back up. Even more importantly, the infant doesn't need the solid foods at that age. They're getting all the nourishment from breast milk, or if they're not breastfeeding, from formula. Early introduction before 4 months has been linked to an increased risk for chronic diseases such as obesity later in childhood. Studies particularly have shown that among formula-fed infants introduced early to solid foods. But also, early introduction to solids ends exclusive breastfeeding. And the American Academy of Pediatrics does recommend exclusive breastfeeding for about 6 months. Early introduction has also been linked to just a reduced duration of any breastfeeding, which is recommended. You know, breastfeeding after exclusive breastfeeding is recommended to continue for 12 months or longer. And so once you reduce the duration of breastfeeding, you're really reducing all the health benefits of breast milk and breastfeeding.
So what's our take-home message here? Just a little better education for parents and doctors?
Yeah, I think better communication of those recommendations. And I think, you know, healthcare providers working with parents, giving very clear and accurate guidance, and then really supporting them and working with them to carry out those recommendations. And when there's concerns such as, but my baby was hungry a lot of the time, 70% of mothers said, but my baby seemed hungry a lot of the time, really trying to understand why a parent is feeling that. If baby's crying a lot, are there other reasons for crying? And really communicating that during those early months, during the first half of infancy, breast milk is providing all the nutrients the baby needs. And if baby's not breastfeeding, formula is providing all the nutrients the baby needs.
Dr. Kelly Scanlon is lead epidemiologist with the nutrition branch at the CDC. The findings from the study called Infant Feeding Practices Study 2 were published March 25th in the journal Pediatrics. And Nina, Dr. Scanlon is a researcher, but not really a medical doctor, so I wanted to talk to you about possibly some problems long-term with starting a child on solid food so early. You've been hearing things that perhaps this could have some, you know, problems down the line.
Yes, there is a lot of research going on now about the microbiome, the bacteria in the gut, and also about the immune cells in the gut. There are so many immune cells. And when you introduce foods too early, it may be that these infants are then predisposed later in life to illnesses such as inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, food allergies. You know, there's a great many food allergies in this country, more than in the past. And one wonders, you know, in terms of peanut allergy and other food allergies, why is that? So they're just starting to look at perhaps early solid food feeding practices may in some way be related. But this is a very complex area. But when I saw this article, it started me to thinking, I wonder if that's why we're seeing more inflammatory bowel disease, more Crohn's disease, more food allergies in this country and internationally.
I know one thing Dr. Scanlon did mention was possibly celiac disease, too. The gluten intolerance might have something to do with this.
I think you're absolutely right. We're seeing more, again, immunologically based disorders of the GI tract, such as celiac disease, Crohn's disease, and other types of true food allergies. So you have to start to wonder about that.
So again, the recommendation of keeping breast milk going for at least 6 months is still the best advice right now, you'd figure?
I think so. I've always thought that way. I think it's difficult. You know, you're a young parent, your child is crying, and you say, gee, they're hungry. And then your mother says, start them on food.
Mm-hmm.
So you do, but I'm not sure that's the right answer. So I think as a parent of an infant, you really need to talk to your pediatrician because they're aware of these issues and the research involved. A study funded by the National Institutes of Health shows a fairly unsurprising link between being frail and food insufficiency. The thing is, it's more of a problem than you'd think. Joe Belimfi from the NIH explains.
NIH-funded researchers, using data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, have found what appears to be a link between not getting enough food and being frail. Dr. Ellen Smith at the Oregon State University explains.
What we found in this study is that people who are frail are more likely to also have food insufficiency, or more likely don't often have enough to eat, than people who are not frail.
She defines frail as when a person experiences muscle weakness, exhaustion, or can only manage low physical activity.
For food insufficiency, it's when they often don't have enough to eat.
Dr. Smith also explains that this is an epidemiologic study looking at the health of a large population and cannot show a causal relationship between frailty and food insufficiency.
I cannot determine causality because it's a cross-sectional study, so everything is it's like a snapshot at one point in time. And so I can only say that these two seem to be associated. And so I do not know if frailty came first or if food insufficiency came first.
But researchers do stress the study points to some important facts.
We notice in this study that close to 50% of the population is either in the pre-stages of becoming frail or frail. And with the aging population, that can have a tremendous impact on quality of life for the aging population. And so, and as a result, if people who are frail aren't able to move around and aren't able to get to the stores, then to me that seems to indicate that we need to provide access to nutrition, to good nutritious food, as well as try and prevent pre-frailty from becoming frail and people who are not frail from becoming pre-frail, and perhaps some kind of an intervention through exercise as well as nutrition.
Dr. Smith also points to a surprising finding contrary to the expectation that frail people would look underweight.
What this study found is that, in fact, a frail person may look underweight, but they may also look obese.
For more information on this study, visit www.oregonstate.edu. To hear more from Dr. Smith on this topic, listen to episode 173 of the NIH Research Radio podcast. And to learn more about health and medical research for older adults, visit nia.nih.gov. This is Joe Belinfi.
Still to come, there are ways to treat age-related macular degeneration, and they don't involve a fountain of youth. We'll hear more next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1307.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
If you're over the age of 50, you are a prime target for age-related macular degeneration. Thus the name. In fact, it is the leading cause of vision loss for people over the age of 50. There are ways to treat the condition, and I recently spoke about some with Dr. Abdish Bavsar, national spokesman for the American Academy of Ophthalmology and a retina specialist and partner at the Retina Center of Minnesota in Minneapolis.
Age-related macular degeneration is one of the most common conditions that affects our eyes after we reach the age of 50. And it increases particularly once we get to the age of 60 and 75 and so on. Some of the main symptoms to look for are distortion in the vision or crookedness, waviness, or faces missing or areas missing in your vision. When it becomes more advanced, there can be crookedness, waviness, distortion in the vision, or spots you don't see out of. For example, you're talking to somebody, but out of your right eye, you can't see their face because there's a spot in your vision or a couple of areas in your vision that are diminished or have blind spots in them. Sometimes it manifests just as blurred vision, so you don't even know if that's really macular degeneration or something different. In fact, many people notice some blurred vision or decreased vision or distortion. They don't really know what it is, and they think they can just put off the appointment and go in for a glasses change. And in the meantime, there's actually active macular degeneration with bleeding and leaking and so on going on in the retina, which is causing loss of vision due to macular degeneration. However, even more important than watching for the symptoms is to have regular exams by an ophthalmologist or a physician trained in diseases of the eye and surgery of the eye, because if we can catch it early before you even know you have it, we sometimes can start treatments to reduce the risk of progression, which may be as simple as vitamins, or sometimes we can treat it with different medicines, and those medicines can help save vision and reduce vision loss before you know you even have macular degeneration.
Now we're talking about age-related macular degeneration. Are there other kinds?
There are other kinds. This is the most common kind. Some other types include myopic degeneration or other conditions, for example, called histoplasmosis or angioid streaks, but those are much less common.
And given the name, I'd assume aging is probably the biggest risk factor. Are there other risk factors, say a family history of the disease?
Sure. We now know that with multiple recent studies looking at genes, that there are many different genotypes or gene mutations that we have in our bodies that lead to an increased risk of age-related macular degeneration. Aging is, of course, the number one. Genetic factors play a role. If we have a lighter iris color, that can play a role. So, for example, those individuals of particularly of Northern European descent have a higher risk of developing age-related macular degeneration. And then we can talk about some lifestyle issues that also increase the risk. And the biggest one that I like to let everybody know about is smoking. We know that smoking increases the risk of these bad blood vessels growing up under the retina. If you can think of weeds growing up through cracks in cement, these blood vessels are not supposed to be in the back of the retina, and they kind of grow like that up into places where they aren't supposed to be, and they cause the retina to get destroyed by that mechanism. And if we can reduce smoking or quit smoking if you smoke, we can reduce the risk of progression of macular degeneration. Other part about lifestyle recommendations are an easy way to think of your eye health is to think about heart health. And everybody knows that for keeping your heart in good shape, you need to exercise, eat well, and stay active. And those seem to be the same for macular degeneration. So eating healthy leafy greens, fruits and nuts, vegetables, staying active, basically keeping your heart healthy and keeping your eye healthy are tied together.
And is this a condition of the actual eye, or does it go down to the optic nerve?
Macular degeneration is a condition that affects the retina, and it can secondarily affect the optic nerve or as a side effect, but it really involves the retina and the parts of the eye under the retina.
So let's talk about treatments for it. You haven't been able to prevent it. You do have the condition. What can be done to make it better, and can it be reversed or just stopped?
Yeah, one of the biggest parts to remember are that we can slow the progression with something as simple as high-dose antioxidant vitamins. in a nutshell, those consist of vitamin C, E, beta carotene, zinc, and copper. When you combine those in a formula that was done in a big clinical trial called the AREDS trial, A-R-E-D-S, that study basically showed that you can reduce the rate of progression of vision loss from macular degeneration. So that's huge. That's the first step. Once you do get it, though, in spite of that, if you do have leaking and bleeding or the wet form of macular degeneration, it's called, as opposed to the dry form, which doesn't have bleeding or leaking, there are three different treatments we can use. And this is great news because once upon a time, it was thought of that this disease could not be treated and there was no treatment except for let people lose their vision. That's definitely no longer the case. And that's the great news. We have three different medicines we can put into the eye that are available today. And across the board, we could use those interchangeably. They're Avastin, Lucentis, and Eylea. So we have three different treatments we can pick from and use. And sometimes we switch them up and use different treatments depending on what's going on. But that's great news. Three different treatments that we have available. Now we put them into the eye with a little tiny needle that goes into the white part of the eye. So it's an injection that we put into the eye. And we numb up the eye and we sterilize the eye and so on. So it's actually a relatively quick procedure.
And I see now there's a new artificial retina device that's been approved by the FDA. Is this something that's going to be put into more use for people, I imagine, who are really in the final stages?
Yes, Bob. Many people have termed this the bionic eye. One of my friends, it's so interesting to know, developed this. His name is Dr. Mark Hamayan. He's a scientist and retina surgeon out in California. And he invented this very neat idea to have essentially an artificial retina. And I'll describe it in a nutshell. It consists of a surgically implanted little microelectrode array that we actually put into the eye onto the surface of the retina with surgery. And then it's got a pair of glasses that kind of look like a pair of sunglasses that you wear. And inside that pair of sunglasses is a little micro camera that actually takes a picture and video of what you're seeing, and it transmits that real time into that implant in the eye. That implant in the eye then stimulates the retina around the areas that are damaged. That goes to the optic nerve, and then that generates vision. It's very interesting to see this and exciting to see this come to FDA approval, and now patients can get this.
And just finally, let's look ahead. What do you see in the future for treatments or even prevention of macular degeneration?
I think that in the time that I've been practicing retina surgery, about the past 16, 17 years, we've had a tremendous increase in the numbers of treatments that we are able to do. And that number is only increasing exponentially every day in terms of medicines that are in the pipeline, medicines that are being trialed. It's a long process because from an idea that starts in a lab to getting clinical trials done and then proving whether the medicine works or doesn't work takes many years. However, the fact that we already have three of these medicines all have been developed in the past 10 years is outstanding, and there are surely more to come. There are many others that are in phase one and two clinical trials right now. And we are working on ways to reduce the need to do injections. There have even been trials looking at drops to use on the eye and trials looking at pills to take. And so the horizon looks very promising. I would definitely say the horizon is full of hope.
Dr. Abdish Bavzar is a retina specialist and national spokesman for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. You can learn more at geteyesmart.org. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thank you.